you think life is simpler after you retire? For some, it's actually more complicated when facing issues about health, estate plans, probate, long-term care, and more. That's why attorney CPA Joe Cordell hosts Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors and an open forum for older adults with important questions about their future. Here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Good morning. Another week of Elder Talk. Susan Arthur, how are you today?
I am doing quite well. How are you?
Well, struggling to stay warm.
Uh-huh.
But it could be worse. I just talked to my daughter who's in Chicago, and she said that she's wading through, 25, 26 inches of snow.
They're getting a lot more than we are, although I'm hearing the word ice come around today, and I'm going, oh, no.
Well, now, and in fairness, what she says is 24 inches, there is a discount factor.
She might not be quite accurate on that.
Not quite. But the point is, it's a lot of snow.
Right.
I think about the fact that, you know, Florida, to a lot of people as they age, becomes mm-hmm. increasingly attractive. And I say Florida because I'm more familiar with Florida. But just say a number of destinations such as Arizona.
Warm.
Yeah, warm. And even like North Carolina, which is temperate. I mean, it has its cold days, of course. Mm-hmm. But still, it's a milder climate than further north. So I think a lot of people think about the possibility as they age of moving further south. When they were younger, they thought, you know, I love this brisk, cold, you know, vibrant climate. And it didn't bother me personally when I was younger. Mm-hmm. It's amazing what your body can put up with in terms of controlling its temperature. How often did you go outside without wearing a coat when you were
all the time,
or earlier?
All the time. You ran outside, you played in the snow until you were sopping wet, and then you came running back in for 20 minutes and back out again.
Yeah, and it's amazing how that changes, though, when you get older,
uh-huh.
for many of us. But I rarely go out with my dog, for example, to walk her without a jacket. Mm-hmm. And there was a time that I wouldn't have bothered, mm-hmm. you know, even in cold weather. But things change.
I know my 15-year-old is in shorts today. And I'm wearing a sweater and a jacket and all kinds of stuff.
Doesn't seem fair, does it?
It does not.
Well, and so I think, though, that is a good kind of transitional discussion
mm-hmm.
as we think about, you know, what about when, as we age, what will be our game plan? And many people have already settled on a game plan in housing, but a number of our listeners still think about possible changes.
Well, and I think a lot of times we want to have options. I may not have decided exactly what I want to do at the moment because I want to see where my kids land and I want to see where family is and things like that. But I want to have those options. And I
yeah.
think that's what we want to do, is try and think ahead, prepare, look at some of those things so that when the time comes, we have those options.
Yeah. And I talk with clients who think that way, meaning that they don't know for sure. And these, incidentally, my clients typically are not affluent. They're typically middle-class clientele, so to speak. And yet they think, is it possible to buy something for, say, $300,000 or less, maybe, in mm-hmm. Florida? Florida comes up more often than other states. But also, for example, Houston, Texas, a client was talking about that area. I mean, there are places that are relatively inexpensive to live in the South. And so people who years ago, I guess our parents and grandparents, you know, would have thought that that was something only the rich did, was have a second home in Florida. And still there are people, though, who think about that and for whom it's reasonable. Now, there's advantages to dumping the one house and moving south to the other, but many people don't want to give up their social connections.
Right. Right. You know, we actually had a neighbor who they retired. And what they did was they bought a house in our neighborhood because they wanted to have connections. They lived in Florida most of the time. Mm-hmm. But when they came home, they wanted a place to see their grandkids. They wanted back to St. Louis. Mm-hmm. They wanted a place to have family gatherings they didn't want to be in a hotel. They didn't want to be in a condo. They actually wanted to just be in a house. So, you know, it's very common to want to have those connections. And they came back about once, maybe twice a month, a little more in the summer, a little less in the winter.
Yeah, yeah. And it is a bit of a juggling act.
Oh, it is.
Between those relationships, those responsibilities. For example, if you attend church in both places, how do you become fully involved? And my wife and I have talked about this too, is when we think about Florida, is how do you maintain your role and your relationships and those things that are important in your church? For us, it's largely the church, but for many of our listeners, it, in addition to that, there may be other organizations that they're very active with. And things change when you disappear for 6 months of the year.
Oh, yeah.
Or 3 months even.
Just shared memories. I mean, oh, remember that time? Oh, yeah, you weren't here.
Yeah. Well, and that today, one thing we were going to do to kind of move into more of our plans for the show is we wanted to talk about this subject, as well as some related items that have arisen in terms of questions that have come up. So we thought that we would list them all and try to get through the ones that we can. And during the course of that, I think that we'll return directly and indirectly to this subject, as well as to others that I know are of interest. Do you want to start us off here, Susan?
Well, I do. And let me just say, we love hearing from our listeners. I mean, it is so encouraging to us when you have a question, because we know that we're striking a chord with you. And so we don't promote it a lot, but I want to let you know, if you go to eldercarelaw.com, that's the website, you can just click on contact and fill out a question for us, and we will answer it for you on the air. Now, we've been talking about housing, and so some of these questions that have come in to us will relate to housing. Some will be your first home. Some are more, where do you live, and retirement homes and that kind of thing. But our first question is, are homes considered an asset when applying for Medicaid? And does Medicaid pay for assisted living facilities? One of the biggest questions we have is, where are we going to live?
Yeah, and the short answer is that real estate counts for Medicaid. However, if you're living in a house, if it's your primary residence, then that house can be exempted in qualifying for Medicaid under a couple of circumstances. One is you have to have an intention to return, and that should be backed by some potential capability of being able to return. Now, that's a very loose definition. Thankfully, it's not rigidly enforced. So that kind of loose expression, I'm mm-hmm. going to return to my home, is typically enough. Now, the other scenario is where you have...
Even if it's really probably not possible, or you as the maybe a child will say, oh, Mom, you're not going back there.
Yeah. Generally, that will not overcome the benefit.
Okay.
So some states are different. This is very much governed on a state-by-state basis in terms of enforcing the CMS, which is the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services. It's a matter of enforcing their regulations across the states. So there is some variation from one to another. However, generally, if there's the expression of an intention to return to the house, then it's not questioned for the most part. However, that only means that the house is exempt. And exempt does not mean that it's safe in terms of having what's called asset recovery. Asset recovery is an action that is brought by virtually all the states now. One time, this was blown off. I can tell you that for decades, though on the books since 1971, in fact, the requirement that states invest authority in some agency to come after and collect assets, that for the amount that was actually paid out during the course of the person's lives in Medicaid benefits. So if they receive benefits of, say, $300,000, then there was an obligation on the part of the states to use in the state of Missouri, the Attorney General's office, to have the Attorney General's office to file the necessary things and probate, et cetera, to be able to execute on this claim they have. Now, I can tell you that it's very aggressive. It's something that isn't blown off. And now there's even an obligation on the part of those involved in the estate to disclose any knowledge they have, any benefits that they had received. However, There are a couple alternatives to that, number one, but also let me complete kind of this definition. So to the extent, though, that you have someone intending to return to the house, then it's going to protect it for a while. Also, if you have someone living in the house who's a dependent, and that can be a spouse and it can be a child. So if someone, one of those is living there, then you go into the nursing home, then that home will be safe for purposes of qualification. It won't be sold. However, I can tell you that right now, if the spouse survives you, it's safe in Missouri. There's no asset recovery action as long as there's a surviving dependent in the house. And then thereafter, as a practical matter, it's blown off. I can't explain this in terms of reading the regs, because the regs don't say that there's any exception for thereafter not being able to collect at the death of the second spouse who did not receive benefits. So you have a surviving spouse. They're living in it. So logically, you think, okay, if they're not going to execute now, could they execute at the death of that person?
Right.
And I can tell you as a practical matter, I haven't seen that happening.
Okay.
So they probably can if we, in terms strictly of what the regs permit, but as a practical matter, it's not happening. So that's a way in which kind of the house might escape asset recovery. But keep in mind, those are several big ifs.
Mm-hmm.
And when I talk to clients and we look at their individual circumstances, there's no certainty about who's going first, for one thing. And the other is, when one person goes into a nursing home, in that scenario, is it possible that the other person would pass before they would, even though they're in the nursing home?
Sure it is. You hear that all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes you think the healthy one ends up having some sort of a massive event, and all of a sudden, then you're really stuck.
You're right. It is really weird how that happens. And many of our listeners I know have known people who've had similar things. So I think that when you're planning for your housing and you're wanting to qualify for Medicaid, the best thing to do is to try to avoid the exempt status for all the reasons I mentioned, just the uncertainty, really. Is it better than no status of protection? Yes, it is. It delays things. It might delay them permanently, given the conditions we talked about a few months ago. But again, that's a roll of the dice.
Well, and could the state of Missouri just change that?
They could. And there's always that vulnerability. So here's what I suggest to clients, those for whom this is something they would consider. And that's putting their assets in an irrevocable trust. In other words, doing Medicaid planning. Some people call it more generally asset protection planning. To the extent that they do something like that, then guess what? It's locked up, period. There is no asset recovery on those. Now, it has to be handled correctly. So it can't be done in a very casual or general way. This has got to be a specific type of trust, and it has to be irrevocable. It has to comply with certain other conditions as laid down by the Medicaid regulations. But if those things are done, and if you have a few other factors coming in your favor, then this would permanently protect the assets.
And then it could be passed on to the next generation. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay.
It can. And many people do this for not only the next generation, but in Missouri, you can do dynasty planning.
And okay, what's that?
Sounds like something that rich people would do, right?
Yeah.
Well, but
or
really,
some TV show from a long time ago.
You and I are old enough to remember this.
I know.
And I bet our listeners are too. But yeah, it means that you can provide for more than the next generation, even the next. You can go for 3-4 generations at least in terms of this planning. This is relatively new. At one time, there were these hoary old rules that had been around since literally 1,000 years ago. And those rules would forbid you having something that's in effect beyond, say, a couple of generations. And now there have been statutes passed, and Missouri is one of those states, that allow you to create trusts and to have them continue and endure for multiple generations.
That sounds pretty interesting.
So the house planning, though, is a big issue. Houses still, let's face it, are the biggest asset people own. Now, a close contender now, it turns out, are tax-deferred accounts, which includes IRAs, 401ks, et cetera. I mean, those are now close contenders on the list of American households' most valuable assets. And some say that because of the lack of interest in the housing market over the last 7 or 8 years, maybe the bad memories some people have from 08, 09, mm-hmm. 10, then many people now have more assets invested in their tax-deferred accounts. But that still is a minority. And so I think that when people are planning, we like to first answer the question, what about the house?
Right.
And then we talk about other assets.
Because even if it's not a huge amount of money, then most everybody has somewhere that they live, whether they have anything saved for retirement or not.
Yeah.
They at least have something normally tangible that they'll have to deal with.
So let's go to another question.
All right. So let's kind of keep on the housing one. I guess we've kind of talked about this, but see if there's anything differently. My father is 84 and recently moved into a senior apartment and is concerned about the earnings from the sale of his house. Now, he's going to go ahead and sell it. Should he be concerned? And what can he do to protect his assets? Trust again?
Yes. The thing that he would do there is he'd benefit, first of all, from the sale of a house. You have this exemption. So he's going to have $250,000 that'll be protected, and if if he had a wife who was living, then it'd be a $500,000 protection. So this is a substantial benefit. There aren't a lot of these give-me's in the tax code. This has been preserved with the tax reform. So it's a very attractive benefit for people as they age, is to know that when they sell their house, there's a certain amount of recovery that they'll be able to keep. And for most people, that captures them. I mean, $250,000 worth of equity, that for most people, that's all they need, mm-hmm. For protection. So that's the wonderful news here, is that there are assets that will avoid being taxed as income, even capital gains income, when it's sold. And protecting his assets, of course, that continues to be an issue. And then that kind of ties in a little bit with the previous discussion.
It does. All right. So let's kind of move along to something we have talked about, and that's power of attorney. We've talked about that. And when we talk about on previous shows, when we talk about our plan, it was one of the things that we need to have is a power of attorney, or durable power of attorney. So the question that this person has is, my husband has been diagnosed with dementia. Do I automatically have power of attorney when he becomes incapacitated? In other words, as a spouse, mm-hmm. do I have to go through the whole legal process with this? Or since I'm taking care of him anyway?
Well, you know, I like to dwell on this for a minute, because it's easy for many people to yawn when this whole discussion comes up of powers of attorney. And I get it when they're substantially under age 50.
Mm-hmm.
I yawned, and I was a lawyer. and the point is, I'm not saying that that's the attitude they should have, because they should have powers of attorney. We all should, our entire adult lives, because of the ramifications. I mean, just to set this up, if anything happens to where you are incapable of making decisions for your life, and this includes that entire range of decisions that you make every day about all matters of your life, legal, financial, things relating to property, your real estate, your cars, your school, your job, your tax-deferred accounts. I mean, all those things that you do daily are things that only you can do, meaning if you're an adult who is emancipated and is competent, then granted, there are certain exceptions where as husband and wife, for example, you'll share decision-making. But that list is not real long. It's not as long as you think it is. There are a lot of things for which this nation, particularly our legal system, vests civil rights in individuals, not couples.
Hmm.
So as to many things such as privacy, that whole range of privacy in the legal sphere, in the medical sphere, in other sphere, education, et cetera, those rights accrue to the individual, not the couple. So and not automatically to the parents, let me hurry to tell you,
I was just going to say, you know, even in college, my son is over 18 and I can't do anything unless he signs a little piece of paper.
It's shocking. I mean, parents, you know, you've paid for everything,
yep.
and you've always made decisions for them, and you know them well enough to know that it's good for you to continue making decisions for them for a while, mm-hmm. at least. And suddenly you find out, you send them off to school, and you find out that you don't have a right to all these records. Mm-hmm. You don't have a right to things that you thought you did. And so similarly, in our adulthood, this authority that we have is exclusive to us. In the vast majority of cases, it's exclusive to us. So imagine what happens when suddenly the person in the command center of your life and all the events and circumstances surrounding it is suddenly incapacitated.
Hmm.
They've called in to work, or whatever metaphor you want to use, meaning they can't make decisions anymore. So you still have this person, you still have these responsibilities and these issues. So who makes those decisions? Well, thankfully, the good news is that as a society, we've decided we need to have a process for this. And that process is having a probate hearing. Probate in this case refers to guardianship and conservatorship. It's the same basic court that makes the decisions relating to, you know, distribution of assets when people died. But anyway, we should all be glad to hear that thankfully there's a process. Now, it's not a happy process. It's not a affordable process for many people. It consumes a lot of time, and it's not especially pleasant for anyone, and it can often be the place of battles. But is it good that as society, that when we have an adult who's incompetent, that somebody be able to step in and grab the controls? So it's essential that we do have this, but I just want people to appreciate that on the one hand, while we know that we're thankful it's there, we don't want to sign up for that approach. It means that doctors testify. It means that a judge is there. There's a hearing, and it often divides families. Mm-hmm. Often there's contention about who should sit in the driver's seat while you're not in it. So for all these reasons and many more that we don't have the several hours to talk about, I think I made the point that because that risk exists for any of us, but especially as we age, the probability, imagine a number, which I don't know exactly what the number is, but imagine what the probability is at that event, whether it's a stroke or a heart attack or a car accident, that's going to happen to your average 25-year-old. And then just imagine a scale in which you add 5 years mm-hmm. in increments thereafter. I'm telling you that percentage with each increment of 5 years goes up.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we can argue about what that probability is that you're going to need such a vehicle, but we can all agree that it's going up. And by the time you hit 60, that probability is real enough and pressing enough that it's crazy for any of us mm-hmm. to not have not a form that says power of attorney, but a document that you know what's in it. You made decisions about what's in it. You didn't sign up like for a North Korean shoe factory for their one of two sizes that were available and simply, you know, put stuff to the shoe with whatever you could so you can wear it. You know, that's not the way to do your legal documents. And it is attractive, granted, to spend $50 for a form that you print off and sign. But think about it. You know, this is a form that's going to govern everything around you. And it's going to direct the people and their authority and what they can and can't do. They're essentially in your driver's seat for the period of time that you're out of it. And you may be permanently out of your driver's mm-hmm. seat. Now, do you want this to be a form like the North Korean shoes that is good enough? I mean, I would think it'd be better to spend the additional bucks, whatever that might be. And I would make this argument, have made this argument, in fact, to my mm-hmm. family members in Kentucky, where I can't represent them, but I feel strongly that it's just foolish to you know, think about saving a few bucks or even a few hundred bucks when we're talking about this subject. There aren't a lot of subjects that arise to the magnitude of the person who's going to sit in your seat and run your life and your stuff for perhaps the rest of your days on Earth.
Yeah, that's...
Who would order a form for such a thing?
Right. It's a big responsibility.
Yeah, and I don't think people think about that.
Right, right.
So yeah, power of attorney is an incredible document, and it allows you to avoid that process I described. You know, when I'm speaking at workshops, I'm kind of quick to applaud the fact that as a society, thankfully, we do have this process that exists for conservatorships and guardianships. I mean, we all look at it and think, boy, I don't want to have to go through that. But we would all hurry to say, yeah, I prefer that to nothing.
Right. I was just going to say, is a guardianship better than nothing?
It is better because if somebody's in charge rules. Now, it's expensive comparatively, meaning that you have the court continuing to have oversight. There has to be payment made to lawyers. The guardian ad litem is typically compensated, and there is delay and whatnot. So it has its many flaws. Excuse me. But the good news is, thank God it's there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if it wasn't there, then this would we would have these people in our society who would be under these conditions who would be continuing to conduct themselves as if they're competent. Mm-hmm. And that's a danger in operating vehicles. Mm-hmm. It's a danger in any contract they sign, any real estate transaction they engage in, many other transactions they might engage in. In other words, none of us as members of a society want to have people who are incompetent loose among us in that way. We want someone to be able to make, you know, good decisions for them. And the guardianship and conservatorship is the vehicle that each state has erected to be able to deal with this. But all I'm arguing to our listeners is never make this plan A. This
right.
should always be plan B. Maybe plan C, but definitely not plan A. And the plan A should be a document. We mentioned a power of attorney. Power of attorney, yes, it can do a lot. But a similar function that served and is really a part of Plan A would be a durable power of attorney for health care. And that's to deal with another sphere of important stuff. Now, we know that the legal stuff, the financial stuff, you got that covered when you have this power of attorney. And you can reach into other things. But as to exclusively health-related decisions and only health-related decisions, it's better to have a separate document. And that's a durable power of attorney for health care. Now, you can place the same person in charge of those things.
Okay.
There's nothing wrong with that, but it's typically these are two different documents.
Two different things.
Two different documents, two different statutes. In the state of Missouri and most states. However, I can tell you, I'll make the same argument. Many people, again, think, oh, I just need to sign one of those forms that they hand you when you go into emergency rooms now. Yeah, check the boxes. But those boxes you check, you know, again, is it simply two or three variations between what you and 240 million other people might choose at this moment? Are these the only options we have? And of course, it's not. And it's silly to think that your durable power of attorney for health care should vary only by those boxes between you and everyone who lives on your street. I mean, the fact is there are many things that can be addressed in that document, some that will be very customized, and they should be, things where you prioritize certain things. A good place to put in that document, it's very unusual to see this, but we're big proponents of it. At Cordell Planning Partners, is to put your care plan in there. Your care plan allows you to discuss things like what sort of care do you want? What if, for example, it's not simply do I cut off the respirator, but instead it's that more likely scenario given science today and medicine, and that's that we're able to keep the body alive. We're still figuring out how to fix the brain. And so you have these memory centers coming up everywhere. How many of you have seen facilities now that are dedicated exclusively for people with cognitive problems? In other words, by implication, these are people who's physically are okay. I mean, you know, given their age. And so you have a facility that the only reason they're in the facility has to do with their brains and not their bodies or the rest of their bodies. So this is the fastest growing area in terms of long-term care housing. And I don't see this trend slowing down. It's not just Alzheimer's. It's other cognitive conditions. So if you think, well, gee, the most pressing health care decision I'm going to have is going to be the one relating to whether to cut off the respirator, you may find that that's only going to come up after about 40 years of other pressing stuff. And 40 years is a long time. But anyway, decade. And so I'm suggesting let's think holistically about what is the possible whole range of issues relating to your health care that might come up? And yes, of course, those relating to whether or not you have artificial nutrition, hydration, whether or not there's a respirator, whether or not there's antibiotics. That issue was brought home to me in a very vivid way with a loved one recently. At first, at one time I wondered whether that, you know, was an important item to have on the list, and now I realize it is. And there are various other things that are on that more traditional area of need regarding this decision making. But it's not simply the two or three boxes, let me emphasize again, that you'll be given if you fill out a form when you come into for some sort of medical care or other healthcare institution. But I also want, though, to move on to emphasize that other range of decisions that are never or very rarely addressed in those documents. And those are the ones I was describing. There's a cognitive problem. And so now you want to take the opportunity to express your desires relating to your care under those conditions. And those will not be found in the typical form that you obtain for durable power of attorney for health care. So the durable power of attorney for health care should be enlarged to encompass those issues about your quality of life. We've had clients, for example, who had emphasized that as long as they are able, they want to be at a religious service, a Christian religious service on Sunday morning. Some of you may, you know, having other religions, would value being at a religious service regularly, health and circumstances permitting. But did you know that nursing homes will have an obligation to fulfill any reasonable request that you have for your care? Now, it has to be reasonable. Has to be feasible, but it's not defined by simply what's convenient to them given their limited budget. It's a more objective definition, and this definition under the Omnibus Nursing Home Act of 2015 has been enlarged and deepened. Your rights are much greater today, and the enthusiasm with which they're enforced is much greater today than it was just 4 or 5 years ago. So if we can look back, you know, appreciative to anything in the Obama era, perhaps one would be that, and that was the fact that nursing homes now are becoming increasingly cognizant of these obligations they have.
This is not something that's necessarily an easy problem or something easy to think about, but it's going to hit all of us, and it makes so much more sense to try and plan this ahead of time and have someone who you're making those decisions. You're thinking about it rather than the spur of the moment when someone is in pain, when someone's dealing emotionally with things. You know, it just makes much more sense for you to try and do that.
Yeah. And I agree. I mean, these are all things that we need to do. And I want to emphasize then that the place to do that, and you won't hear this many places, so when you talk to your lawyers about a durable power of attorney for healthcare, don't allow them to reach for a form, or more likely you won't see a form because it exists on their computer. But but the bottom line is there should be very customized things that you want and care about that should be on that. And they should consider the possibility that there will be some substantial period of time when your physical health will be reasonably good, but perhaps not your cognitive. And in that scenario, think about the quality of life. We've had other people who have emphasized that, weather permitting, they want to be outside for some substantial part of time or period of time during the day, whether it's an hour, 2 hours, whatever. So types of food. Some people feel that if I can't express the type of foods that I like, I want to be able to document that this is what I care about.
Well, you can be really specific in these.
Yeah, you can.
Yeah, that's encouraging.
It's encouraging, and you can have the assurance that there's an obligation on the part of the skilled care facility to, if possible, if reasonable, for them to fulfill that.
All right. Well, you know what? We've got a lot of really good information here. Let's take a break, and we'll be right back after this.
You're listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors, presented by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. And now, attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Okay, welcome back with more Elder Talk. Susan, we're going down the list of some questions from the website. So was there another one that you have?
Well, we've been talking about power of attorney, and I have one more power of attorney question follow-up. And this one's just kind of a simple little question, but you never know. It says, a few years ago, I gave my son-in-law power of attorney. Now my daughter and he are separating. How do I change my power of attorney, and do I have to notify him that he's no longer my power of attorney?
Well, this is an interesting question. So the son-in-law was appointed, which it's not that unusual, I guess.
I guess maybe the thinking was maybe he had some skill in that level or in that area, and he was probably going to be a good person, didn't anticipate any sort of a problem, and now perhaps things are not so great with the son-in-law, and now what?
Yeah, and you know, this triggers, I guess, a step back point, and that's a point that whenever we make this decision, we need to keep in mind people, of course, that often tell clients two qualities that I value for this role above all others. And that's that they are honest. In other words, the person you choose should have integrity and honesty. And number two, they should be people that have good judgment. And I think those, you know, when you strip away the requirements for this role, those two are really the most important. Because if you have the integrity and you have the good judgment, you can bring in experts. You can bring in people that will be very helpful and informative. And it's not necessary, for example, that you have somebody in the family or someone close to you who is a lawyer or a accountant or such as that. Though it's very easy to obtain that advice when it's needed. Mm-hmm. So I think the most important requirement for this role is the good judgment and the honesty. Now, regarding this question more specifically, there is a fiduciary obligation that someone has in this role. And now that phrase fiduciary is a very solemn obligation under the law in America. And it with it implies all these selfless obligations. You have to behave in a in a very with a very high standard of disinterest, meaning nothing that benefits or profits you. So you have that in at work. So I just want to I like to call people's attention to that. Some people are kind of dismissive about about one's position in this role, that they can do whatever they want when they want to do it. And it is, incidentally, a relatively loose position to hold. So there is a wide range of discretion. I grant you that. That it may be stronger to have someone with this authority inside a trust as a trustee, in my opinion, because a trust is typically defined more specifically, and there's a host of laws that govern that are triggered that are apart from those for the power of attorney. However, just talking about the power of attorney, yes, it does provide a wide range for discretion. So you want to choose somebody who you do think is honest and has good judgment, but you also need to be aware that the fiduciary requirements are significant. As a lawyer, I don't minimize those at all, and I do think that they affect people's decisions, and they also give you and those with an interest a cause of action when there's a suspicion that they have behaved in some way that's not consistent with that. Mm-hmm. So it's not meaningless to have that standard. But is there potential for abuse? Abundant.
A lot, yeah.
There's abundant potential for abuse.
All you have to do is look at some of the questions we have, and you yeah. kind of see that, life doesn't always go exactly as planned.
No, and I'm looking down this list of questions that we both have before us here. But on this one, you don't have to formally revoke it, but it's best, in order for it to be effective, there's not a revocation process, quote unquote. What you have an obligation to do is to notify anyone that you have reason to believe would be relying on it, because they can kind of be like an innocent, it's called a third party purchaser or a bona fide purchaser for value. That's what that phrase means, is when somebody who has no way of knowing your relationship with somebody else, like where they were a former employee, now you fired them.
Right.
And perhaps this company's done business for years, and so that former employee goes in and buys something in the name of your company. Guess what? It's possible that you would still be liable to pay for that. It's possible. And the mm-hmm. theory where that happens is that, look, this person had a longstanding relationship. You knew they bought things from this former employee, and that they would reasonably conclude that the employee had that authority. So there's similar rules in the law that would allow someone, a third party, to be protected from their reliance on something that this person does in your name, like a bank letting them have certain things. So here's what I would say to you in answer to the question. Go ahead and notify people who you know have the potential of being contacted by this person, that perhaps they have done so in the past, your son-in-law. So it would include banks, other financial institutions. Anybody that you would have reason to know would act on it. And yes, should you notify him? You should. Again, you want to create a track record of demonstrating that you've been diligent, you've done all the reasonable things that you could do, and as a result, if he goes out and does something in your name, there's a good chance that you'll have no obligations or liability regarding that. But it's your responsibility, though, to act in a reasonable, conscientious way to notify third parties that you have every reason to believe will be and have relied on it. Hope that answer makes sense.
Oh, that's great. That's great information, because it wouldn't necessarily be one of those things that I think you would think about. But, I mean, obviously, a difficult family situation and all of that, but you still need to protect yourself with it. And it just seems like something you wouldn't even think about, but you better act on it just to make sure.
Mm-hmm.
All right, I think we have time for one more question. Let's kind of circle back around to kind of go back to where we started from, talking about some of these long-term planning and long-term care and where we're going to live and that kind of stuff. One of the most important things. And you have, in the past, we've talked a lot on this show about the concept of kind of using Medicaid coverage in order to pay for your long-term care. Now, this person says, can you just expand on this idea? And they're struggling a little bit with, is it unethical? Is it illegal? I mean, what's in place for all of that?
And with our clientele, this question comes up quite a bit. And I think the reason is that the middle classes, for the most part, and as I mentioned earlier, that really is our core clientele. And I'd argue the middle class is the core clientele of those who are doing Medicaid planning. If you think about it, who else would? Meaning, if you're poor, if there's any good news for you, it's that your health care is covered.
You get Medicaid.
Yeah. I mean, you easily qualify. And then if you're wealthy, then of course it's not an issue. You know, your intention is that you're. And I have friends who don't understand all this hoopla about Medicaid because they've just taken it for granted that they would pay for their long-term care. Many of them still believe that Medicare covers that.
Yeah.
But the point is, when they find out otherwise, they'll be able to afford it.
It won't matter.
But what about that great bulge in the middle on a bell curve? You know, if you think about a bell curve and you think of all those people in the middle, which is like 80% of the population, certainly 70%. These are people who own some assets. For the most part, they've been paying for the programs that others have enjoyed their mm-hmm. entire working lives. They're people who've been net givers to the economy. They're not takers. They have not applied for programs, quote unquote, and they're not comfortable with the idea of planning for programs. So these are the people that struggle most with this whole question. Is the government is something that they've never asked anything from except for protection of their property rights, protection from foreign
right.
invasion. And for the most part, you know, that's and they pay their taxes and they go about their lives and they manage things themselves. But this is a big mountain to climb.
It is.
So for the first time, they come up on this mountain called long-term care. And they realize that the magnitude of these costs, especially given the technology we have today, are insurmountable, and that it easily means that they will have to forfeit. They'll have to surrender everything they've worked to accumulate for their families and their children, their grandchildren, their entire lives.
Well, and even a house. I mean, you think, we've talked earlier, your home is your biggest asset or your retirement fund. It you can go through that, what you've spent your entire life, 30, 40, 50 years building, and it will be gone in maybe a few years.
Yeah, easily. I mean, at a, pardon the phrase, at a burn rate of, say, $10,000 to $12,000 and maybe $15,000 a month.
And that's not unusual.
No, it's not, certainly in the St. Louis area.
Right.
So what I want to say to these people in the middle classes who are struggling with something they've never done before, namely apply for a program,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I'm a little impatient with that, but I applaud their honor. But it's come the time where you know, they've paid for everything up to now, and now it's time for them to receive their fair share of their citizenship. And it's not an unreasonable thing. And in this case, it doesn't mean doing anything illegal, certainly not, or we wouldn't be doing it. It doesn't mean doing anything that's unethical. It means that you take advantage of the laws that are out there, just as you do in many other areas, as you do in tax law, for example. You know, most of us now are comfortable with taking advantage of any exemptions, exceptions, deductions.
I was just thinking that. You know, I remember going to a sermon one time and the pastor said something like, if it's an allowable deduction, take it. I mean, why would you not?
Yeah, and we all are comfortable with that idea. And even going to extraordinary lengths to take advantage of tax opportunities as long as they're legal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that idea I think that we're all comfortable with now. And this is nothing more than that same reasoning as applied to health care. So what it means is that you want to take advantage of the laws that are there to fully utilize them for you at a time when what's at stake is the things that you've been able to accumulate and conserve for an entire lifetime. That's what's at stake. And this is something that could, you know, change the quality of life for your loved ones, maybe for you in some other respects. So I'm not by any means impatient with that discussion because I understand where it comes from. And I respect where it comes from because mm-hmm. it comes from something good and honorable, and more people should have
right.
such reservations.
Right.
But I hurry, though, to reassure my clients that I think this is the way you should think about it. Some don't end up agreeing, you know, but it's a minority. But there are a few that don't.
Mm-hmm.
But most, yeah, when they think about it, you know, they concede that you know, in the past they've not had to avail themselves of such things, programs. But now the time's come.
Yeah.
And there's a lot at stake. So that's my general response to the whole discussion of Medicaid.
And are there any disadvantages to doing that? I mean, we've talked a lot about the advantages. Are there any disadvantages that might hinder someone?
Well, usually the Medicaid planning requires giving up some level of control. In other words, it would be unreasonable to expect that you're going to have all the same benefits without giving up some amount of control. So let's say that you have $500,000. And if you have $500,000, you want to qualify for Medicaid because you want the $500,000 to be used by your spouse, your surviving spouse you expect, and your children and your grandchildren. So Medicaid planning can take several forms. So I don't like to or I'm careful, rather, about giving examples because sometimes people latch onto them and think, oh, that's the way you do it. And the fact is there are many ways to do Medicaid planning. But one of the more common ways involves using, as I mentioned earlier in the show, using an irrevocable trust.
Okay.
And as the word irrevocable implies, it means making a decision that in order to protect your assets, you're willing to limit in some ways your use of those funds. And that's only reasonable. And you should be suspicious of anybody who says that they can do Medicaid planning for you, where you're able to say in good faith to governmental authorities, you know, whoever they might be, that you don't have the assets to pay for this care. In order for you to make that statement in good faith and integrity, then there has to be some way in which it's true.
Mm-hmm.
So be suspicious of anybody who talks to you about Medicaid planning where you have the same access, the same use, you know, all the same availability of your funds that you previously did. So Medicaid planning usually involves that not always, but often involves creating this irrevocable trust, and this trust will have rules where you can manage the money, but there's rules as to ways in which you can use it yourself. There will be rules about whether you can take off the principal, for example, and use it for yourself. You can use it for anybody else. There will also be rules about income. Often you can continue to pay yourself the income. So income from dividends, interest income, income from other sources. I mean, those are, you know, it's okay to define it that way because you're going to disclose that income.
Does it have a limit? I mean, like if you're receiving income, is it capped at, say, $50,000 or $10,000?
Well,
or?
It doesn't work that way, but there's an effective cap, meaning that effectively what Medicaid's willing to pay for is the shortfall that you have between the income you have and the cost of the nursing home.
Okay.
So if you had $12,000 income and the nursing home's $10,000, then you're not going to get any Medicaid.
Okay.
If you had $9,000 income and the nursing home's $10,000, then you get $1,000.
Okay.
So income is often not the issue in this discussion. It's more about the principle. And since we're about out of time here, we have about a minute and a half, I won't be able to go into the sort of detail that I would like. And maybe many of you are saying, thank you.
But then somebody's going, no, wait, I need to hear more.
So I do want to emphasize that Medicaid planning, in my opinion, is perfectly ethical. Matter of fact, I go much further than that and say that I think that it's stewardship. I think it's good stewardship. It's using the laws as you should in a responsible way, just like you do the tax laws. It's your duty as a citizen and as a member of your family. Boy, we've covered a lot of territory here, haven't we?
We have. There's so much more we could talk about.
Yes.
But again, if you have questions, just go to the website, eldercarelaw.com, and click on the contact button and just send us your question. We'd love to hear it.
Yeah, and you know, it'd be boring if we solved all the world's problems in this hour. What else will we have to do in the future? Talk to you next time.
Been listening to Elder Talk, providing smart strategies for seniors with attorney CPA Joe Cordell. Listen again next Saturday for another edition of Elder Talk, sponsored by Cordell Planning Partners, your elder law advisors. For more information, visit eldercarelaw.com. That's eldercarelaw.com. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.